They were raised on small, poor ranches in opposite corners of the state. Jack Twist in Lightning Flat, up on the Montana border. Ennis Del Mar, from around Sage, near the Utah line. Both high school dropout country boys with no prospects. Brought up to hard work and privation. Both rough-mannered, rough-spoken, inured to the stoic life.
Welcome back to the final selection of the first season of Literary Guys. I'm author Zachary Kellyan.
And I'm Dr. Gordon McCallum.
And that was a quote from Annie Proulx's masterpiece, Brokeback Mountain.
I'm happy to be talking about it here on a very blustery day that actually makes me think of being up on top of that mountain.
Yeah.
Just tending to the sheep. Nothing else. Nothing else really happens in this book, right? This is about taking care of sheep on a mountain.
That's my understanding. I mean, certainly they're not stemming any roses up there.
I get the idea that there might be some subtext to this book that I'm just completely missing, but I don't know. Like, it's not really spoken of directly.
So I think this is interesting. Our listeners who have been listening to us for a while, I believe they know that I identify as straight. You identify as gay, but I was the one who recommended this book. You had never read it before.
I had not read it, and I also have never seen the movie. Still true to this day, I have not seen the film.
And if my memory serves, when we were talking about this, you had been a little trepidatious about even approaching the book. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I'm always trepidatious of media that seems to become very popular in, let's just call it, you know, straight circles, that tends to be about gay characters. Like, it tends to be something which is idealizing the image of what gay people are like and how they think or wish that they would act, and therefore it becomes popular in heteronormative culture. But what I found in this case was something very different from that, and I think that that's really why it resonates. It seems to exist into a world unto itself.
Yeah.
And it seems to be a world which is very true. It's about a very real and raw attraction that in some ways actually transcends sexuality. Mm-hmm. Even though there are some very clear signs that occur in the book that this is about homosexuality and not just about two people who are deeply attracted to only one another.
Yeah, no, and I'm glad you felt that way. I'm glad that this book resonated with some truth to you. I think it's just absolutely masterful. You know, one of the things we really strive to do in Literary Guys is talk about emotion. Dr. McCallum, did this story make you cry?
I've read it twice now, and I've been in tears both times I have read it. And in fact, the second time you read it, and I'm really genuinely hoping that our listeners have read this, it is so short. Mm-hmm. You can read this in a little over an hour.
Yeah.
Please stop listening to this podcast. Go read the book and then come back, because you'll then realize that the way in which the book begins is actually telling the end of the story in a very tragic way, but in a way that you don't necessarily even understand what's going on at that point. Mm-hmm. It just seems to be a slice of life of someone selling off their ranch. You don't understand why, you don't understand the symbolism of what happens there. But reading it a second time, I was in tears before I got off the first page.
Yeah, and I'm not laughing at your tears, because I'm man enough to admit this is the seventh time that I have read the story, and I openly weep each time I read it. It's one of the few stories on earth that can do that, and I think it's what you alluded to earlier, because to me, as a straight man, it's not a quote-unquote story about gay cowboys or homosexuality. It's a story about two people who love each other. And regardless of what your natural attraction is, be it to the opposite sex, the same sex, asexuality, whatever, I think love is emotion we can all relate to. And I think the love is so profoundly on the page here. And credit to Annie Proulx for giving us this work.
I'd like to go to a quote that speaks to that love before it actually manifests in a deeply sexual relationship. They were respectful of each other's opinions, each glad to have a companion where none had been expected. Ennis, riding against the wind back to the sheep in the treacherous drunken light, thought he'd never had such a good time. Felt he could paw the white out of the moon. That one just really cut at me. Like,
yeah.
There's something about that, dare I say, infatuation.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't even have a way to speak of it, but he has this elation that he's never felt before. And it's just that he was spending some time with some guy. I think they were drinking a little bit of whiskey and eating some beans out of a can. I could be thinking of like five other scenes where that happened in the book, but it wasn't anything deep or, you know, transcendently introspective. It was just something where he felt that attraction, and he didn't even have words to put to it as he was riding back in the cold up the mountain to tend to the sheep.
And I think that's one of the strokes of brilliance that we see from Annie Proulx in her kind of structure of this story, is that we see everything through Ennis Del Mar's perspective. Mm-hmm. You kind of get the impression, there's some contextual clues early on and certainly later in the novel, that Jack Twist has lived his life as a gay man. Not openly so, but he is aware that he is gay, he's attracted to other men, he's been with other men. Ennis doesn't seem to even have a vocabulary or even a roadmap as to what this type of relationship looks like. But as that quote so expertly illustrates, he's kind of just going with the flow. He knows what he feels. He's not a man who's good with his words. He's not a man who is in touch with his emotions. Mm-hmm. But this is something he is feeling, and it is real, and it is true. And, you know, Ennis Del Mar does not do anything half-assed, so he's going at this full throttle. And I think to be along for that character's journey is something that can bring any reader into the story.
Mm-hmm. And for him to, again, be grasping at the emotional element of what is going on. There's that scene when, after everything has transpired on Brokeback Mountain and the season, as it were, for the sheep has ended, and he and Jack part ways. There's just a great scene of him not being able to necessarily cope or even comprehend what was going on. I'm going to go back to the book here.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it a few times in this episode.
It's one of the most lovely written pieces in the English language, so please do.
"Right," said Jack, and they shook hands, hit each other on the shoulder. Then there was 40 feet of distance between them and nothing to do but drive away in the opposite directions. Within a mile, Ennis felt like something was pulling his guts out, hand over hand, a yard at a time. He stopped at the side of the road, and in the whirling new snow, tried to puke, but nothing came up. He felt about as bad as he ever had, and it took a long time for the feeling to wear off.
Yeah. One of the great tragedies, I think, of the book is we later learn that Ennis only, it took him a year to figure out why he felt that way. He thought it was food poisoning at first. You know, he didn't even have kind of, like I said, the fluency in any kind of love or romance, mm-hmm. let alone a homosexual romance, to know that what he was feeling was just profound heartbreak and lovesickness. And and I think that's something that a lot of us, to one degree or another, have felt. And that scene is just gut-wrenching because, man, you just want him to turn around. There's so many chances that they want to take to be together, but of course the time and their culture kind of prohibits them from doing so, and it's just so crushing.
You know, it is really interesting looking at the sex scenes which are described in this book.
I think we have one sex scene and maybe one post-coital scene.
With Jack and Ennis?
Mm-hmm.
I think definitely we have the one that occurs up on Brokeback Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
We also do have one with Ennis and his wife.
That's true.
Which is a troubling scene. And actually, I think is the one physical way which we see that Ennis is dealing with not having Jack there. Mm-hmm. And for our listeners who have read the book, they know what I'm talking about here. But it's a very troubling thing to see.
Yeah, and the novel's sympathies certainly lie with Ennis, and I think that probably most of the reader's sympathies as well. But if we can't just for a moment talk about his wife Alma, she gets a really raw deal here. She seems like a really good, decent person,
absolutely,
who is caught up in a problem not of her own making, a problem that hundreds and of years of Puritanism and false machismo have kind of created for her. But it really is a sad thing that, you know, here she is, just she's working double shifts at the grocery store just to pay for the work that her husband can't bring in because he's too much of a loner. He's too lovesick still over Jack to even really have much initiative and everything. And when they are affectionate, it's not the kind of affection she craves.
Right. And there's that moment where she sees the affection that she wants shared between Ennis and Jack in the doorway, if I'm not mistaken, when they're reunited. I think it's a couple years, right?
Four years later, Jack, out of the blue, sends a postcard saying, "Hey, I'm going to be up in Riverton if you're around, and you know, maybe we can just catch up over a beer or something like that." Ennis immediately writes back to him with just a "you bet."
Mm-hmm.
and they can't keep their hands off each other. You know, they Ennis says he didn't know what to expect. Jack was expecting this the whole time, but Ennis, you know, didn't really know what to expect. He just knew he missed his friend. But of course, mm-hmm. being there with the love of his life once again, he can't contain himself. And yeah, they just passionately kiss right there and basically in front of his wife and kids.
So I actually hadn't thought about it before, but was it a postcard that he sent?
Mm-hmm.
Because I hadn't connected that with the other postcard, which is... Right. Do you think that's intentional?
I think that's very intentional. I think there's nothing that Annie Prue does not do that is not intentional. A little bit about our author here. She lived in Wyoming for about 20 years, lived on a ranch, very much a solitary person. So while she herself does not identify as gay, she's been married several times to men and is not herself a dedicated rancher like Ennis or Jack. I think it is interesting that, you know, she's lived a very solitary, open range kind of life in Wyoming, and that's the truth that she already knows.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think this novel probably resonates so well, is because it's not too much of a leap for her just to talk about love and emotion and those human complexities that bind us all together regardless of our sexuality. So I think that's one of the reasons why a straight female author, at least to me, is able to write two gay men so convincingly.
I would go even a little further beyond that, which mm-hmm. is that she's able to write this very accurate inner portrayal of closeted gay men.
Yeah.
That, I think, is even trickier to pull off, because most closeted gay men put a lot of time and effort into maintaining a different outward image of who they are to the world. And to accurately portray, as I believe she does a fairly good job of, the inner turmoil that feels very accurate that these characters are feeling, at least particularly Ennis, that to me seems to be the masterstroke of this.
Do you think if they had been able or allowed to live an openly gay life, they would have been much different? Or at the end of the day, are these just ranch hands who live and die as ranch hands who also happen to be gay?
I think it really comes down to a sense of identity mm-hmm. when you do that. Like, people search for and seek identity in their lives as much as it is thrust upon them. And it is interesting to think, like, does Ennis consider himself to be anything but a ranch hand, even at the end of this novel? Would he call himself a gay ranch hand? I don't think he would.
Mm-mm.
I would actually go so far as to say that I don't think that he himself realizes how much of his identity it actually is, and that he's pushing back against it. You know, one of the things, we talked about this a number of episodes back, this idea of coming to accept the fact that being gay is part of one's identity.
Right.
I personally, for years, was like, well, I don't want to be considered as, like, that gay individual, and to have people think about that is like one of the first things they think of when, you know, they recollect me or they tell someone else about me. And it's troubling. It is a troubling thing, particularly for someone who wasn't out for a long period of time, to be able to cope with that particular sense of the identity that other people interpret about me.
Mm-hmm.
But I've since come to accept that, no, it actually is very much a part of my identity that I'm proud of. And that is maybe not the first thing I bring up in a conversation, but it's, I've gone from not wanting people to think that about me to being much more of like, oh, that's just part of who I am. And lots of different people are going to think about me lots of different ways. I can't control what that is. I'd rather have them know the authentic me.
I guess... Thank you for sharing that. I guess kind of taking it away from homosexuality for a moment, just men in general, gay or straight, isn't this a problem that all men have? That men are often defining themselves by their vocation or by the one rodeo belt buckle that they have. And that mm-hmm. these trappings of masculinity, especially in, you know, the 50s and 60s, where Brokeback Mountain begins at least, mm-hmm. are so much of a man's life, where it's not about his wife or kids, it's not about his passions or his loves, it's about, you know, I'm a ranch hand and I put in a hard day's work, or I won this minor rodeo circuit, you know, 20 years ago and I still got the buckle to show for it.
It absolutely is. I actually don't think that much of it has changed
yeah.
Since then. I think most people, when they talk about themselves, one of the first two or three facts they will give is what their job is. Given the culture that we live in, particularly in what I'm going to dub the creative class, folks who are in more thinking-type oriented jobs, that it seems almost all-consuming. You know, this is very different from ranch hands, but, you know, thinking about people who work in the tech sector, for instance, like, their identity is defined by that. I think it's very much the case that it hasn't changed, that masculine identity is so tied up with vocation. Mm-hmm. And once you do that, then you get into this sort of masculine rat race of like, well, I'm in a higher level position than you are, so I must be more of a man because of that, which is nonsense.
Or in this case, you know, I've got more calluses on my hands, so I put in more work, which makes me more of a man.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the case may be. Yeah, and I think that's why this novel is so accessible even to straight men like myself. Because I can see myself in these men. You know, I haven't known a love like theirs. I've only loved women in my life, but I think I've certainly loved people, and I've certainly had really confusing relationships with love, in part because of society's expectation for me as a man and how much emotion and affection I'm allowed to show as a man. And so I think that's a really interesting gateway into these two men's world that hopefully anybody reading this book can really relate to.
Mm-hmm. This very much is about cultural and societal expectations. I think it's good that you brought that up, because I think that's really what this comes down to. Mm-hmm. That I've got to imagine, even right now, in parts of Wyoming, that this is just as much taboo as it was when this takes place in, what, the 1950s? That it's still very much tied up with not just being a man living in Wyoming, but also being in a traditionally masculine job and the expectations that that also carries with it. I hate to almost kind of broach into the subject, but I will, because that's what we do here in mm-hmm. Literary Guys. But, you know, I think the huge taboo that still seems to exist is gay athletes in professional sports. Like, the numbers don't add up on this one, people. Like, the percentages in society do not line up with the fact that there's, like, two openly gay professional sports athletes in all of professional sports in the United States. Like, that doesn't line up, you know, at least with the ones that have major television coverage.
Anybody who's watched American football can tell you that there's no way in hell all those men are straight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, it's one of the tragedies of this story is how they are unable to be together, and some of the violence towards homosexuals that are seen or imagined by these two, the realities of what it would mean to be openly gay and the dangers of that in this time. You know, in some ways, it hasn't changed too much. One of the cases that I think you and I both remember from our childhood was mm-hmm. that of Matthew Shepard, a young man in Wyoming who lost his life because he was trying to live as a gay man, and there were people who didn't want to let him experience that. And so, to me, it is very heartbreaking to read the tale of Jack and Ennis, but also really important to remember that there are some people out there that are still going through this. I mean, you know, you and I are lucky enough to live in a progressive place, in an urban center, where a lot of different viewpoints and lifestyles are tolerated. Not everybody has that luxury, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And people internalize it.
Yeah.
It's this idea of, I don't want to be that outcast. I don't want to be that other, for lack of a better word. You know, I want to be part of the group. I don't want to be chastised. I don't want to spend my life trying to define myself as this independent other being. Sometimes people want to feel normal. I think maybe the last quote that I'll read here today is very much on that topic. Ennis pulled Jack's hand to his mouth, took a hit from the cigarette, exhaled. Sure as hell seem in one piece to me. You know, I was sitting up here all that time trying to figure out if I was... I know I ain't. I mean, here we both got wives and kids, right? I like doing it with women, yeah, but Jesus H. Ain't nothing like this. I never had no thoughts of doing it with another guy, except I sure rang it out 100 times thinking of you.
In a way, that's as romantic as these two guys can get.
It's very true.
But it is kind of just shocking. You know, I think it reinforces for me when I read this that, you know, Ennis, I don't know if it matters how he chooses to identify himself. What is very apparent is that he loves Jack. And that,
so true.
That's
so
all true. That matters to him, and it's all that should matter to us.
I couldn't agree more. Like, he is, in his own way, very much trying to live authentically. He doesn't know how.
Right.
He literally does not know how. If it has to do with the fact that he thinks that the right thing for him to do is to try and live in the sham of a marriage with this, as you point out, this woman who seems to be a genuinely good person, who, for the most part, turns a blind eye. We'll talk about that next episode. You know, he just doesn't know. He actually doesn't have in his mind an idea of what it would really look like.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a scene where they talk about, hey, maybe we just like go get a ranch and we can just go do that. And it's like, it's so naive.
Mm-hmm. It's naive, and it's so heartbreaking because when they have that kind of that last faded moment up by that nameless lake later in their years, they're trying to figure it out. They've never figured it out. They're just bubbling over with frustration. It's that famous line, I wish I could quit you. Mm-hmm. All that's going on. But to me, the line that really stands out is Ennis says something to the effect of like, well, shit, Jack, do you got any better ideas? And Jack's like, mm-hmm. I did once. And he's talking about that moment of just letting everything go and not caring what other people think and living together and loving together. And he's like, I did once. I had that idea once, but it's so far gone now from our reality. And to me, it's just soul-crushing to hear that.
Well, here on Literary Guys, we always like to end on a soul-crushing thought. So I think that's probably a good place to wrap things
up. That's why we're
today.
Drinking straight whiskey for this episode.
I think that's... is that a first?
It is. Yeah, we usually go cocktails. And we sat down here at the Stardust Lounge and looked over the menu, talked about some concoctions with Crystal, and then just pointed to the High West whiskey up on the top shelf and said, let's just pour double of that.
This is some original Boo Rye.
Original Boo Rye, not from Wyoming, but from Utah, from a nearby state. So this is a true prairie whiskey that we are drinking, and probably not too dissimilar from what, you know, Jack and Ennis had in their flasks. We don't have any beans. They didn't have any canned beans today at the Stardust Lounge. Mm-hmm. Usually that's more of a happy hour special for them.
But I feel like the steaks we're having, and we usually have steaks when we come to the Stardust, that feels pretty much authentic. Although maybe we should be having some lamb. It feels like it would be appropriate.
Certainly not fish, because they weren't catching any fish up there.
No, they weren't. We'll touch on that one in a subsequent episode.
But I guess just to kind of wrap this episode up, at the end of the day, I find this to be one of the great works of American short storytelling. And I'm curious to see if my esteem for this is one that you hold as well, or do you feel like it's justified in terms of what it gets right and what it kind of champions?
I absolutely feel like this is one of the best short stories, if we want to call it that, maybe a novella, that I've ever read. The fact that I knew what was coming, I knew it was going to happen, and I still, just the waterworks from this one. There's something very true and naked that I almost can't describe about this story. It's about people who are forced to believe something that society and even themselves don't want to believe, as particularly in terms of Ennis. And I think just that would have made for a good narrative.
Yeah.
But then you end up with what happens in the second half of this book. It's just devastating. And it doesn't need to be one word longer.
Nope. It's pitch perfect throughout. You feel the blistering, biting cold. You feel the loneliness. You feel the hunger. You feel the heartache. You feel the longing, and you feel the love. And it doesn't matter, you know, what your sexuality is, what your relationship status is, where you come from before you read this book. I think everybody who reads this is kind of forced into the same experience. And it's the experience of the unfulfilled dream and the unfulfilled love that these two men are forced into. And I think that's something that we can all relate to. And I think that's what great writing is.
Well, let's leave it there then.
We like this story a lot.
Yes, we do. I need to have some more whiskey here. I'm feeling sad just thinking about it.
Well, I'll feel sad right along with you, because that's what real men do. We experience emotions together.
Okay. Well, with that, I have been Dr. Gordon McCallan.
And I'm author Zachary Kellyan.
This has been Literary Guys, signing off.